Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Folks, we're very fortunate to have Dr. Joe Cantor join us, Assistant State Health Officer, as he does every Thursday at this hour. And we really appreciate same. Doc, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Noel. Nice to be back again.
Doc, so give us an update. Obviously, you and I have talked about this a number of times. We were concerned about when we opened the economy back up that numbers would go up, and they seem to be going up.
Yeah, there's no question about that. It's been a real challenging 3 weeks for the state and the region to, we look at our neighboring states, Arizona, Texas, and Florida mostly, and there are these incredibly high outbreaks now, and our trajectory is similar. We're not at that level yet. We're not threatening our hospital capacity, but our rate of increase is just about as fast as it was, back in early March. So we're highly concerned about that, and we're just seeing widespread community spread from a number of different locations, and that's only for the cases that we know about. You know, we know that the contact tracing apparatus can, it knows what it knows, basically, and there's a lot that it doesn't know. And what it does know is indicating that there's just widespread community spread. When you do the numbers, there's about 20 to 25,000 active and infectious cases of COVID across the state that are diagnosed, likely 3 to 4 times that are undiagnosed. So not much has changed from last week. It's still a very tenuous time for Louisiana and the region, and a lot of reason for people to be cautious when they're outside of their house.
Obviously, government response has been to step back on the phasing and reinstate some of the restrictions, right?
In a sense, it has. You saw the mayor announce yesterday a couple of things. One of the things that got lost in the conversation, though, is what Mayor Cantrell noted about bars not being able to have people stand around inside the bar. That was actually already within the Phase 2 guidance. It's already right in the Fire Marshal's Phase 2 reopening guidance that people have to be seated at tables, like it's a restaurant, even if it's a bar. The challenge has really been enforcement, and it's just tough to enforce this stuff across the board.
Yeah, I guess, and this is going to sound strange, but I'm still just trying to get my head around this. How does this come to an end? I mean, when we think about the virulence of this infection, and now they're saying that in some environments the particulate matter could stay infectious for a longer duration. We now have some folks saying it's airborne. How do we get out of this? I mean, how do we break the cycle? Because it just seems to me that we will be doing this for quite a long period of time. I mean, obviously, until a vaccine is here, we'll open the economy, we'll retreat. We'll open, we'll retreat. I mean, So I'm just having a difficult time trying to figure out how does this change?
Yeah, it's really challenging right now to see how this ends or to how it substantially changes from the starts and fits that we're seeing right now. And you think ahead to schools reopening in the fall. I mean, man, that is going to be challenging. It's going to be hard to keep folks protected, and it's going to be hard from an absenteeism standpoint because, we got to be honest with families, have to be ready for this. You know, anytime a case has popped up, unless you can prove that there was strict distancing in that classroom, then the whole classroom needs to quarantine for 14 days. That's what's happening now with daycares all the time. Really, really challenging. You know, I think we've got to get better at the things that we know work. It starts with masking. I mean, masking can really decrease the rate of spread in an indoor environment. It really, really can. And the more we do it, the less spread there'll be. I think that's the first thing. And the second thing is, I think we need more. If we're going to keep the economy open at the level it is now, it has to be done in full cooperation with both businesses and patrons. You know, not just the letter, but also the spirit of the guidance. I don't think that's happening now across the state. And if it continues and cases go up, you know, you just take options off the table. And at some point, you're left with no other option but to close back down. So those are my concerns. I share it with you. It's difficult to see that, you know, a month from now, things are going to be much different.
And I'm even looking further than that, because when I listen to Dr. Fauci and others, what seemed to be a high level of confidence that there might be some successes relative to a vaccine sooner rather than later, what I'm reading now, that seems to be waning a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And as some of these studies get down the road a length of ways, they're not getting the results that they originally thought they were going to get. And, you know, and now we have flawed studies, and I'm reading a whole host of articles about manipulation of data, obviously, because the profit motive here is going to be, this is going to be like hitting the mother load, right, if you find the solution to this problem. And, you know, and obviously this has become very misleading, and now people are getting very skeptical as it relates to the manner in which some of the studies are being conducted.
Yeah, there's a profit motive. There's also political considerations.
Yeah. You know, I didn't even want to go there.
Right, I know. Yeah. Nor did I. You know, Fauci has been clear, both in public and in private conversations, that he will not stand for any interference in the scientific process for the vaccine. I trust him, but it's going to be challenging. And the other thing is, you talk to a virologist, and what they consider to be effective might not be exactly what a layperson considers to be effective. It's like when an oncologist tells you that that they have good response. I mean, to an oncologist, that could be a few percentage points.
Right.
It's the same thing here, you know, in, you know, a vaccine that is 65% protective might be considered a success from a virologist standpoint. It's not the immediate panacea that I think folks think it's going to be. I mean, it's a big help, but it will take time for that to really change the dynamic on the ground. It certainly takes time to distribute it and administer it and figure out who gets it first. So, and all that to say, I think we've got to be thinking about this, like you allude to, in the longer term mindset. And, you know, we had really hoped, like a month ago, that by the time schools were opening up, it would be a different story, either with less virus circulating or the amount of resources we had. I mean, there were conversations a month ago that, hey, maybe we could test every kid in school and have a testing program. I mean, that would be great, and that would go a long way to reducing transmission, but testing is short, and people, you've seen the news, it's getting shorter. So we're still having these challenges that are just so frustrating, and you know, it makes the interventions that we do have, like masking, really that much more important, because we don't have a lot of tools left right now.
So, I mean, I get back to that original question, though, is, and I understand the difficulties. I just, the expectation of the public, I think, is way off of where this ultimately is going to end up being, because I just don't see how we break the cycle. Because if it remains as virulent as it has revealed that it is, just having a couple hundred cases out there, if we went on complete lockdown for the next 6 months and then we came out and it's still out there in some way, shape, or form, it would seem to me that statistically this thing is going to go right back to where we are right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that big concern on that. I mean, I think we cloud what we hope to happen, and we hope that our kids are going to be in school and it's going to be safe and there's not going to be interruptions, and the schools are going to be well equipped to take the precautions they need to. That may happen. That may not. I mean, it may take a lot of work from now until then, and I really hope that we're up to putting that work in right now.
Doc, how do we explain the differences of the experience, and maybe we're not getting good data from countries in Europe, but, the Denmark, Sweden, Germany, France now, a lot of these countries, the kids go to school year-round, and they just have more breaks during that year. But a lot of them have been in school since April, full-time. And mm-hmm. they haven't had an experience rate or a transmission rate anywhere near, at least with some of my reading. But how do we explain these differences? And I've had people tell me, well, they're doing different remediation techniques. But what are they doing that's so different?
Without being too much of an expert, just from knowing what I've read, publicly, which I'm sure is similar to what you've read, my sense is that they're prepared to resource these schools in a way that we're not prepared to do. One of the good practices here would be to stagger your school and have a group of kids come in the morning, a group of kids come at night or in the evening. And a number of European schools are doing that. You have half the class size, essentially. But then you have to double your busing contracts to make that practical. And that's right. A real stumbling block for a lot of schools here. I've seen schools in Asia put up plexiglass barriers around each desk in situations where they can't move those desks 6 feet apart. That's a cost. I've seen other areas do testing programs for their students. We're not at a point here where we have that resource available. So I think it's countries that probably pour more money into their public school systems than we do anyway, perhaps. But it's there are ways to do this safely. And, for example, the NBA is going to figure it out. They're going to figure out how to have games safely and televise it and run their business. We can do the same for schools. It's just going to take resources.
Right. And so when we think about, well, it's more of a political question, but the financing from the federal government, obviously they're the only ones that can pull the resources together in a short period of time. They can print money. The states can't, as it relates to those issues. But the prioritization, it seems to me we all were thinking that we were going to be going back to school in the fall, and now it's within 30 days upon us, and we're looking around, and I guess we're recognizing we're not ready.
Yeah. That's my concern. I tell you, I can't believe that we're 5 months into this and we're still really hustling for testing supplies and reagents. And, some of the testing offered in our community now is seeing 14-day turnaround times. And that's just absurd. It pretty much defeats the point of getting tested. And to have this happen at this point in the game it's just not encouraging. It's really frustrating.
Well, I was going to ask you that question because I asked someone that question yesterday, and I fumbled through it because it sounds like a stupid question, but I'll try it again. What is the real value of the testing at this point in time? When you just made that observation, because that's what I've kind of been reading too, is that if we're waiting so long for the results, what is the value of the test?
Yeah, it really diminishes.
And how often should you be tested? in a perfect world, if we had unlimited supplies, in order to really track and trace and do whatever we need to do relative to this, how many tests in a month should an individual have?
Yeah. Back up a second. It's to be clear for folks, it's not every community test in the region that's having that turnaround time. It's right. It's one particular lab that's having that. Quest, for example. LabCorp, another lab, is having about half that time. Still too long, but not 14 days. The tests that are going to Ochsner and LCMC, they're having to limit how many they can run a day, but they're still turning those around within a day or two.
Right.
So it kind of runs the gambit. But it's, you know, to have a turnaround time like 14 days, I mean, first and foremost, it's just an insult to the individual. You tell someone to go out and take off half the day and go get tested. And there's risk in that, too, because you're waiting in line exposed to other people who are getting tested for a reason. There's risk there. And so it's of absolutely no value to the individual. I mean, maybe it's of some epidemiologic value because you still 2 weeks later get a count of how many cases were positive, but it's meaningless. And it's particularly frustrating because we've invested so much in this contact tracing apparatus. I mean, what's the point of contact tracing a case that's 2 weeks old? So those are really frustrating. You know, we've been communicating these frustrations to the White House, the federal partners. There'll be a delegation of federal partners coming to town to Baton Rouge next week. We'll continue that conversation. But you know, we find it just completely unacceptable, particularly at this stage in the game. We got to get better at this.
I mean, is this just a function of, obviously, we've had supply chain management problems. We've outsourced to other countries what we have done in the healthcare delivery system for probably three decades, at the very least. Is this just going to be a function of retooling, rebranding, redeveloping, reengineering the way we do business here? And it may take 2 to 3 years to catch up.
It might. You know, what's causing the squeeze now here is multifactorial. So, for example, one large hospital system had one of their large testing platforms go down. It's back online now, but it took a hit when it went down. The other large hospital system here is being told by the manufacturer of their testing platform that they're short on reagent. And so they're limiting how much reagent they get, and that limits how many tests they can do a day. That's why you see some of the testing sites capping. And separate from that, you have LabCorp and Quest, which, you know, we are sending, you know, to be fair, we initially told them we were going to send them X amount of tests as a state, and now we're sending them, you know, 2X or 3X amount of tests. And
they're doing all the other lab work for the regular healthcare delivery stuff that they normally do as well, right?
All the other lab work, and they're seeing really increased volume from other states. I mean, Texas, Arizona, Florida, I mean, now they're blowing up, so they're sending them much more volume as well. And I mean, I'm not angry at these labs. I think they're doing the best they can. They you know, it's their business. The more they test, the more they make, and they're trying really hard to do it. But the whole system is just straining under its whole weight. And, you know, it feels like the second we fix one part of it, something else breaks. Like, you know, a couple months ago, it was swabs, and then it was the viral transport media. Well, now it's reagent. And it just, you know, we're driving this car, you know, much faster than it was designed to go. And it's we're hitting up on the max. It's a frustrating feeling.
Well, I know we have some folks that have some questions for you. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer. 260-1870 or text 260-1870. We'll be right back. We're back with Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana. The state has performed roughly almost 900,000 tests, which I guess, Doc, that's about 20% of our population, is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been shooting for 4 to 5% of population per month, and we've been hitting that goal.
With some of the trials and tribulations that we talked about relative to supply chain, reagent, and things of that nature, does it look like that we may have difficulty in achieving that goal in the coming months?
I don't think so. I think we'll be able to stay the course. And I tell you, I mean, as frustrating as it is, to be totally honest, we're much farther along in testing than a lot of other states. And when we talk to colleagues in other states, they still have extremely restrictive testing programs, really restrictive in who can get testing, even at this point. So as frustrating as it is, we're still in a better spot. And I do think we'll be able to keep that level. My worry is, you know, particularly with schools going back, and there's just going to be more demand for testing. And I worry about our ability to meet the increased demand.
do we anticipate the governor saying something about whether or not schools we will reopen? And, you know, we have a lot of governors across the country now making these statements one way or the other that they're going to reopen their schools. Is that something that we're contemplating here?
I think he'll say something. I don't know what it'll be yet. I mean, he really wants schools to be open, and he's spoken a lot about how important it is for kids. I don't think he's going to do anything that's cavalier.
Right.
And he's not going to put teachers and students at risk. But he's going to try and find a way to make it to get to a safe yes. But that's challenging to get to right now.
Well, we got the calls stacked up here. Let's go to Sally on line one. Sally, you're on with Dr. Joe Cantor.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a question in regard to, I am a healthcare provider, and I work in a non-traditional setting, and I was not feeling well last week. I called the hospital where I see a primary care provider to see about getting a test for COVID, and I did not qualify because I did not have shortness of breath, breathing problems, cough, or fever. It seems like we should be moved beyond those classic symptoms in order to get testing, especially, is there any sort of prioritization as far as those who can get testing? I foresee maybe even teachers running into this problem as school starts. If you don't have fever, cough, or shortness of breath, you don't qualify for the test, which is puzzling to me.
Yeah, it's a great question, Sally. I'm glad you raised it, and thanks for the work you're doing, by the way. You know, what's happening is, in general, the criteria in terms of the feds and the state of who can get a test is extremely loose right now. But on the ground, if a particular clinic or a particular provider only has X amount of tests available to them that day or that week, they're going to do what they can to ration or to triage and make the best use of that. And that's what we're seeing now. So, you know, for example, the walk-up testing site in New Orleans, you know, at the moment it's triaging by just limiting to 150 people, the first 150 people who line up. You know, you could easily make an argument that maybe they should just, instead of doing that, limit it to people that have a certain number of symptoms, and you can make that argument back and forth, and that might happen, you know, if time goes on. But those decisions are kind of made at the very local level based on how many tests they have available to them or what they think can be processed. For someone in your shoes, though, you know, I would say a couple things. Number one, there are other places to get tested, and I can name a few. Walgreens has a good testing program. It's out at their what used to be a Walgreens store, now it's shuttered in Harvey, and they do it in their parking lot there. You have to pre-register and reserve a spot online, but it's very easy to do, and it's smooth. And then there are other community testing sites still available, like the Ilaria Center, Celebration Church today, St. Mary's of the Angels in New Orleans. So there's a couple of the testing places to use. That said, your intuition that just because you don't have those three or four hallmark symptoms that you still might be at risk, that's a good intuition, and I agree with it. You know, COVID can be weird, and we're seeing all types of strange presentations. And, of course, we're seeing a lot of asymptomatic or really mild symptomatic infections. So my advice to you would be assume that you are positive. I mean, if for anyone in the community now, if you feel sick, you know, there's a decent enough chance that it's COVID right now to warrant staying out of work, particularly if you think you might expose vulnerable people. So that would be my advice to you right now.
Okay, Sally. Thank you so much.
All righty, thank you. Let's go to Tom on line two. Tom, you're on with Dr. Joe Cantor.
Hi, I have a question I've been wanting to ask for a very long time. I understand that we're testing for antibodies, And I guess what I find interesting in the age of post-Elizabeth Holmes is, can we actually tell what that you have COVID by seeing the presence of antivirals, I'm sorry, of antibodies, or is it that we're just giving people a positive test out of an abundance of caution? And I would really be interested to hear that. And also, do you think that there's any other labs like the ones that Elizabeth Holmes was running, where she kind of duped everybody for 10 years into thinking that she was actually a diagnostic company? And I'd just like to hear you talk on that point.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, good question. Holmes, you know, she was doing a lot more than antibody testing, or I should say saying she was doing a lot more than antibody
yeah,
testing.
That's one way I put it.
Yeah. The antibody test right now, it is kind of the Wild West in that there's, you know, the FDA regulation is light right now, and there are concerns that there's cross-reactivity. You know, COVID is a type of coronavirus amongst their other types of coronaviruses, including common colds. So, you know, most of us have been exposed to a coronavirus before and have antibodies to that. And there's concerns that they might get cross-reactivity to those tests. There's also concerns about what does it even mean to be antibody positive, and does it mean that you are that you can be assured that you're immune from getting it again? And the answer is not proven yet, and it might not be yes. It might be potentially, but not definitely yes. That said, antibody tests are very useful on a population basis to get a sense of how much spread has happened. So a couple weeks ago, Ochsner released the results of a nice prevalence study, a seroprevalence study that they did in the New Orleans area, where they checked antibodies on something close to 2,500 individuals. And they tried to do a representative sample. And when they controlled for demographics, they estimated a 7.8% prevalence. 7.8% of the community, they estimated, has been exposed or currently infected with COVID. That's a useful piece of information. The challenge with these antibody tests is it's less useful on the individual level, and we're not at the point yet that you can get a positive antibody test, take that information, and act on it. You can't get that test and say, great, I've already had it, I don't need to take this precaution, or I can go be with this vulnerable person and not put them at risk. I'll tell you, we have seen people get reinfected. The reinfections that I've seen have been more mild than the initial infection, but we've seen it. So there's still a lot out there that we don't know, particularly with antibodies. And while highly valuable on a population base and an epidemiologic basis, not yet ready for prime time in terms of acting on it from an individual's point of view.
Dr. Cantor, how long do you think it will be before we have meaningful data relative to reinfection rates? Because that in and of itself really just complicates what we were talking about before, trying to break this cycle.
Yeah. I think we'll have meaningful data on the short term. You know, like what's the risk of being reinfected within a few months? Because the CDC is studying this, and they're able to study it in captive population, so to say. They're able to go do a visit to a nursing home and come back every week and collect more samples. Same thing with jails and prisons. So they're getting data, and I expect them to publish that relatively soon. The larger question of what happens 6 or 12 or 18 months out, I mean, there's really no way to know that until you get to that point. We haven't known. No one,
right.
No one has
and
lived with
because
COVID
we're still
long.
In
yeah.
the infancy of this, infection,
yeah.
right? Or
yeah.
virus.
Yeah, but you know, if there's a sliver of hope, we really do think that if reinfection is happening or possible, that it's that there's some level of protection, that it's a milder infection. That's a decent guess to make right now.
Yeah. All right, we got to get to a break. We'll be right back with Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer, answering your questions, 260-1870 or text 260-1870. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We're back with Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer. Doc, I got to ask you this question. I read an article the other day. A psychiatrist had contracted COVID back in March. 100 and something days later, is kind of still experiencing this post-viral symptomology of achiness in their legs and their hips, low-grade fever. It comes and it goes. Are we confident about the efficacy of this testing to make sure that someone actually is no longer infectious and clear of COVID?
Decently confident. I've heard similar stories. In fact, a friend of mine here in New Orleans had a very similar account and had protracted symptoms lasting about 7 or 8 weeks, if I recall. You know, sometimes people get these post-viral syndromes where a virus, and it doesn't need to be COVID, on rare counts, the flu can do this, chickenpox can do it. A virus can have very strange effects. Sometimes viruses can cause neurologic damage. They can cause a syndrome called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which can give paralysis. In rare cases, any virus can do this. I think that's probably what's going on is these strange post-viral syndromes. You know, we have seen people test positive on the PCR diagnostic tests for very long periods of time, you know, upwards of 2 months after becoming infected. The going belief is that they're not shedding live infectious virus, that they're shedding dead nuclear material, RNA material, that gets picked up by the test. So it's picking that up, but it's not actually live virus that's picking up. And this is confirmed because the CDC does culture studies. So they'll swab individuals and do the RNA, the PCR test, as well as culture it and see if they can culture out live virus. And they tell us that from the time somebody gets infected, you've got on average about 10, 14 days or so for the vast majority of people of when they're going to be shedding live dangerous virus. After that, they might test positive, but it's far more likely to be just viral material that's not actually live virus. That said, you know, medicine is weird, and it is certainly not impossible that there are individual rare cases where that general edict doesn't hold true.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but this gets more and more frustrating for me. I can only imagine what it's like for you guys that, you know, that are looking for more definitive answers all the time. But it seems like there's really nothing definitive about this at all.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, that's a lot of medicine where it's nothing is absolute. Everyone's different. Everyone reacts to medicine different. And you take a study, which is, you know, an average essentially, and you make the best call at that. But there's always room for individual variants. That's something that we're kind of familiar with. I will say we apologize to your listeners, Noel, because this has been a darker conversation of ours in general today. So
no, but these are questions that I get from people every day. You know, so I kind of collect them up and I try to do the research and I try to find the answers and it's frustrating. You know, and I sense the frustration in the folks publishing the articles, you know, that do this for a living, that they're just, they are grasping, trying to get their hands around this information and they can't seem to find it.
Yeah. And they're working much quicker than the scientific community typically works. You know, typically it takes decades to learn this type of information.
Yeah. I'm sure you're reading a lot of the same things I'm reading. I mean, you can just feel the sense of the frustration.
Yeah. There is some good news, though. We're getting better at treating patients. We're intubating less patients, putting less patients on ventilators, and steroids have proven effective. So that's some good news.
Absolutely. Doctor, once again, thank you so much to give up so much of your time. We truly appreciate it. Our listening audience absolutely appreciates it. They look so forward to your hour here every week, and we appreciate the same. Stay safe, my friend, and stay the course.
Thank you, Newell, and stay safe, everyone out there.
All right, Dr. Joe Cantor, Assistant State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana. We'll be right back after the break, folks. Stay with us.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.